Testing. Hello. Yep, we're here. Steven, you want to tell us what we're going to do?
Yeah, so we're here in a strip mall in Morrick, Rhode Island.
Meet Steven Porter. He's a professor at Brown University. He lives on the east side of Providence. He recently became a vegetarian, and he's never eaten a McDonald's hamburger.
We're about to go into a big sports bar.
Yet Steven's driven here, in his Prius, to eat something that might have a dramatic impact on the future of our food and the planet.
All right, should we go in?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
Welcome to Possibly,
where we tackle big problems from a new angle, using science. I'm Nancy Pick.
And I'm Megan Hall. At Possibly, we know that the food we eat, the stuff we buy, the cars we drive, everything we do has an impact on our future.
And we know that we can't keep this up.
So we have a choice.
We can continue to eat, drive, and shop the way we do, and just deal with the consequences.
Or we can make some changes now to protect our future.
But what are those changes we should make?
And how do we know the difference between a real solution and a nice idea?
That's why Possibly exists.
We talk to scientists who study these questions every day
to look at the ways we're changing our planet and uncover some surprising possibilities for solutions.
Here in New England and around the world.
Let's get back to Steven, that Brown professor we met sitting in the parking lot at that sports bar in Warwick.
Steven stays awake at night, thinking about the challenges we'll face in the future.
That's his job, really. He studies the ways humans are changing our environment.
And while he's sometimes overwhelmed by the work we'll need to do to slow down or even reverse these changes, he still has hope.
There is a path forward, but it's not always intuitive. And it's often more complicated than you can get in a soundbite or even a short op-ed.
Like many in his field, Steven realized that talking to other scientists about this path forward wasn't enough to make a difference. Everyone needs to join the conversation.
And this podcast is that conversation.
Today, we're talking about food.
It's actually a pretty personal topic. Whether you're a vegan, a carnivore, or a locavore, you probably have an opinion about what we should eat and where that food should come from.
But what does the science have to say about the best way to grow our food?
And what are some changes we can make right now to make sure we all have enough to eat in the future?
Because there are some pretty big challenges ahead.
Challenge number one. Climate change is bringing higher temperatures and more extreme weather.
Big rainstorms, long droughts, 100-year floods happening every 2 years.
These are all things that kill crops and make it harder to grow food.
Challenge number two. We're going to need more food because we'll have more people to feed, probably about 9.5 billion by 2050.
Steven says we're already using huge areas of land to grow food and raise meat.
If you added up all the farms in the world, we farm an area of about South America's size, and we graze animals on an area about the size of Africa.
Pretty soon, we'll have to make some hard choices about where and how we farm.
So what can we do?
One possible solution led us to that sports bar in Warwick, Rhode Island.
But first, let's look at some other possibilities.
Possibility number one. Buy local food.
Meet Pat McNiff.
From Pat's Pastured, and you're in East Greenwich, Rhode Island.
At your farm?
At my farm. Yep.
Pat raises pigs, chickens, geese, and other animals on about 150 acres of land just off Route 4.
We're in suburbia. All this used to be farmland at one point, and now it's pretty large acre house lots and estate lots. We're one of two farms left in the town, us and a dairy farm.
As one of the few farmers left in this suburban landscape, Pat's first priority is raising delicious food.
There's a peach farmer who says, you know, I don't sell peaches, I sell the memory of what a good peach tastes like. And I think we do the same with meat. We don't sell turkey, but we sell what the memory of a good turkey tastes like for Thanksgiving.
Pat also does everything he can to reduce his impact on the environment.
So this is our compost area.
He composts all the waste from his farm.
And even takes in food and yard waste from the community.
And then there's the field of solar panels he's putting in to generate electricity.
On top of that, almost everything Pat eats is grown or raised in Rhode Island.
You know, open up our fridge, I think the only thing we buy that isn't local are like avocados and, you know, olive oil and some of those kind of things. Coffee, too. That's another big one we don't grow around here that we need a lot of.
It seems like Pat is doing everything right.
So does he, and conscientious local farmers like him, hold the answer to our food future?
Scientists say, maybe not.
farmers markets are not going to solve the problems of the world.
That's Dave LaBelle. He's a professor at Stanford University who studies how changes in the environment will affect our ability to grow food.
He says buying local food from small farmers like Pat McNiff is great for the local economy.
And small-scale, conscientious farmers can help innovate new techniques for growing food.
But we've passed the point where we can rely on small farms to feed the world. The numbers just don't add up.
If you wanted to put that much labor into agriculture, you would really have to go against the historical tendency for people to not want to spend their days, you know, in backbreaking work of agriculture.
Also, growing our own food the old-fashioned way, with organic manure and water from our hoses, turns out to be really inefficient.
You know, I probably spend $20 per tomato that I harvest from my backyard, and that's not even pricing in the cost of my labor, which is probably a good thing because I'm not very good at it.
Remember Stephen, the Brown professor who started this podcast? He agrees with Dave LaBelle. He says that beyond concerns about efficiency or our ability to devote our lives to agriculture, there just isn't enough space to grow all the food we need here in New England.
You know, by 1800 or so, New England had almost no trees left except on the steep hillsides. And the reason for that is because we were producing all the food we needed in New England, and not for very many people. We couldn't possibly grow the food for New England in New England without cutting down most of the trees that have regrown. And even then, we wouldn't really come close.
So if local foods alone can't solve our food problem, what can?
We'll talk about another possibility and eventually get to that Warwick Sports Bar after a break. Before the break, we were talking to food experts Dave LaBelle and Stephen Porter about local food.
It turns out that local food might be delicious and great for Rhode Island's economy, but small-scale farmers simply can't feed everyone in New England, let alone the world.
Dave LaBelle says if you want to do something to protect the future of our planet, buying local food actually ranks low on the list of things you can do to make a difference.
For example, what kind of car you drive and how many times you go to the store back and forth because you forgot to buy milk or something, that's going to matter a lot more for the carbon footprint of your eating than whether you're buying local or non-local food.
But let's get back to how to feed 9.5 billion people.
In the face of extreme weather and limited space.
Dave LaBelle and Stephen Porter say there's no avoiding it. We need large-scale agriculture and technology. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
We produce nearly twice as much food as we did 30 years ago, and we use less energy, we use less pesticides. We're getting better at it because of technology.
But technology and large-scale agriculture have some pretty major drawbacks, too.
Water pollution, loss of habitat for wildlife, soil erosion, carbon emissions, to name a few.
Which leads us to possibility number two, rethink large-scale agriculture.
If we need large farms to feed the billions of people on Earth, what can we do to change the way those farms work so they don't create as much damage? Okay,
great. We called an expert on large-scale agriculture to get some ideas.
We are recording.
Okay, fantastic.
I'm Lisa Schulte Moore. I'm a professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University.
How do you briefly explain what you do?
Good question.
It's always hard, huh?
So what I do is I try to make agriculture better.
Lisa is a big proponent of the farms that look nothing like Pat's, the large-scale ones that grow soy and corn in Iowa.
But she's happiest when she can get away to the small 40-acre farm her family has owned for six generations.
Enjoying that connectedness to that particular piece of land that has been, you know, so instrumental in my family's history.
Like Dave LaBelle, Lisa recognizes that big farms are here to stay. But she knows this way of growing food leads to some major issues.
For example, soil erosion.
In Iowa, where Lisa works, 70% of the state is covered by either soy or corn. Those crops are seasonal. They're only in the ground for part of the year.
And that's a problem, because the rest of the year, those fields are bare.
Rain and winds whip through those uncovered fields, stripping the land.
We're here in the breadbasket of North America and some of the most fertile soils in all of the world. And yet, because the way we do agriculture, it's estimated that we've lost about half of our topsoil.
This erosion makes it harder for farmers to grow as much food. It also lets pesticides and fertilizers stream off the land and into the water supply.
And as our weather gets more extreme, with stronger winds and more intense rainfall, this erosion problem will only get worse.
But Lisa and her team have a simple solution.
They encourage farmers to grow small strips of prairie in between their crops.
These strips, full of native plants like grasses and milkweeds, act as a buffer when the wind and rain beat down on the topsoil.
What it does is it acts basically as a speed bump that slows that water down so that it's less able to then move soil.
Lisa and her team are seeing some impressive results.
When you interlace about 10% of a field area in prairie strips, you reduce the amount of soil loss from that field by 95%.
95%? That's really impressive. I mean, did you expect it to be that high?
We did not.
Farmers seem to like the strips too.
Last summer, Lisa was walking the fields with one of the farmers in her project.
You know, he just got so excited. He was bubbly when he was talking about his prairie strip. And I said, well, you know, Tim, you make it sound like, you know, your prairie strip is your favorite part of your farm. And this guy farms 800 acres. And when I asked that question, he said, it is.
Lisa and her team are working to expand the prairie strip project to more farms in Iowa and across the country.
She says the strips are so popular, it's difficult to keep up with the demand.
It's just one example of how scientists are working to improve large-scale agriculture.
But is that enough? Can we rely on scientists to fix big agriculture so we all have enough to eat and feel good about where food comes from?
We'll talk more about that and finally eat at that sports bar in Warwick after a break.
Welcome back to Possibly. Before the break, we were talking to Lisa Schulte Moore, a scientist who studies how to improve big agriculture.
She's pioneered a simple technique that reduces soil erosion and helps farmers grow food in more extreme weather.
But there's a problem. Most of the corn and soybeans those farmers are growing, they're not for people. They're fed to chickens, pigs, and cows.
Here in America, we've gotten so good at growing cheap food that we can afford to feed it to animals instead of ourselves.
But it takes about 20 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of edible meat.
So the more meat we eat, the more land we need to satisfy our growing appetites.
Every year, the United States uses up enough land to cover the size of California, just growing food for livestock.
If we keep this up, we'll just run out of usable space.
If everyone on Earth was a vegetarian, we'd be able to feed the 9.5 billion people we expect in 2050 just using the land we're already farming.
Of course, it's not that simple. For one, this would hurt the kind of farmers Lisa's trying to help. They earn a living growing the corn and soy crops that are used to feed animals.
And there are places in the world where malnutrition is an issue, and meat is the only affordable source of protein.
But for the rest of us,
let's consider possibility number 3. Eat less meat.
Now, being a vegetarian is nothing new.
But it's not easy, especially if you love the taste of a good steak or a juicy hamburger.
That's why Stephen brought us to that strip mall in Warwick to try something that might help us eat less of that red meat.
We're making the Impossible Burger. What's the Impossible Burger?
The Impossible Burger is, it's impossible when you think about it.
That's Mark Greco, the manager at Aruga's Sports Bar, doing a cooking demonstration on the roadshow last year.
When people hear burger, they think traditional, like a beef burger.
Right.
But this is all...
It's plant-based.
While it is plant-based, in part, the Impossible Burger is not your typical veggie burger made of black beans and quinoa.
You'll never know you're eating a burger that's made strictly from plants. It's pretty incredible. I'm not going to lie. I was blown away when I tried it.
The Impossible Burger contains a secret ingredient that makes the burger look pink and juicy and taste like meat. We'll get back to what that secret ingredient is a little later.
But the point is, the Impossible Burger isn't designed for vegetarians. It's made for meat eaters, with the hope that the taste is so convincing, they'll eat it instead of beef, at least some of the time.
It's just one example of a new wave of products that hope to replace meat.
And it's about as far from Pat's farm as you can get.
Steven says food like this that creates convincing imitation meat but takes nowhere near the space we use to feed and raise livestock could be a real game changer.
Imagine a world where you could get food that tasted like meat but was plant-based. That would be a world where we needed less land for food production.
So we went in search of this veggie burger that acts like meat to see if it was convincing enough to help change the future of our food.
At first, we could only find it at fancy restaurants in Boston and Cambridge.
But now you can eat one at Logan Airport or at Aruga's Sports Bar in Warwick.
So on one cold winter day, Stephen and I drove to Aruga's.
So is Nancy here?
Nancy met us in the lobby, and we walked to our table, past the 116 TV screens.
There's a special insert for the Impossible Burger. It says, eating one plant-based Impossible Burger instead of a conventional ground beef burger saves 75 square feet of land that would normally be used to raise livestock.
Stephen thinks that fact sounds about right.
But the menu is a little vague about what's actually in an Impossible Burger.
The way I would explain it is that...
That's Canada Ferroni, our server at Aruga's.
She tells us about the special ingredient that makes a meatless burger taste like meat.
Heme is what is in the blood of animals, and that's what makes it red and juicy and all that sort of stuff.
Actually, it's a little more complicated. You may have heard of hemoglobin. It's in our blood, and it's part of what makes meat taste like meat.
But some plants, like soybeans, produce a very similar molecule.
So the makers of the Impossible Burger copied the gene that produces that molecule in soybeans, implanted it into yeast,
and voila, a fungus that tastes like a cow.
Which sounds absolutely disgusting.
So Canada, if the menu said genetically modified yeast implanted with a hemoglobin-like molecule from soybeans, do you think people would still buy it?
I don't think so, no.
But the burger is selling. At Aruga's, about one out of every 15 customers orders an Impossible Burger instead of a meat burger.
The Impossible Burger arrives with a tiny green toothpick flag that says Impossible.
I took the first bite.
It's surprisingly good. If you blindfolded me, I would not know that this wasn't meat.
Okay. Look, I can see that.
That's not an overwhelmingly positive response.
It's close to meat.
Yeah, it wasn't identical to a hamburger. The inside was moist, the taste was meaty, but on the outside, the texture wasn't quite right. Still, much better than the fungus burger I imagined.
But what does this mean? Why does it matter that scientists can now make a yeast burger that tastes pretty much like meat?
Here's one possibility.
Do you think that McDonald's could maybe start serving this and no one would know the difference?
It seems to me better than McDonald's, but don't sue me. But what a revolution that would be if McDonald's started serving this.
Think of it this way. Americans eat about 3 burgers a week, which adds up to about 50 billion burgers a year.
If you replaced most of those burgers with a meat substitute, you'd free up enough farmland to cover Maryland and Delaware, or make that 1 Massachusetts and 3 Rhode Islands.
That could be an exciting possibility.
So we started this episode with a farmer who's doing everything he can to raise delicious, environmentally friendly food.
And we ended in a sports bar, eating a genetically modified yeast burger designed to taste like meat.
It just goes to show that if we want to actually play a role in the future of our food,
and not just accept whatever happens to us,
we'll need to examine some unexpected possibilities.
Where no solution is simple
or complete.
So what is your task, dear listener? What can you do to make our food future a little better?
Here's Stephen's advice.
Eat a little bit less red meat, and if you want to make a big difference, eat a lot less red meat.
That's with or without the help of an Impossible Burger or the other products trying to replace traditional meat.
Pat McNiff, the farmer from East Greenwich, has a second suggestion. Right now, about a third of our food ends up in the trash. We should compost it instead.
There's almost not one community in the state of Rhode Island that composts its food waste. And we could be creating a lot more soils just by what we throw off and goes in the landfill.
Lisa Schulte Moore, the professor from Iowa, says, know your farmer.
By cultivating relationships between the consumers of food and the farmers themselves, we can break down some of these, you know, high-minded ideals about what agriculture should be and have a real conversation about what's actually possible.
And Dave LaBelle, the agriculture expert from Stanford, offers this word of advice. Keep an open mind. Don't reject a new approach to food just because it seems too sciencey.
A lot of people will downplay the importance of science, but then somebody in their family gets sick and they go to the doctor and they don't ask for the science of 30 years ago, you know.
Our advice?
Keep listening to Possibly. Until then, I'm Nancy Pick.
I'm Megan Hall. Possibly is written by us,
and mixed by Megan.
Music and sound design is by Thomas Van Buskirk.
Stephen Porter is our founder, executive producer, and ultimate fact advisor.
Funding comes from the Institute at Brown for Environment and Society and its program for environmental and civic engagement.
With in-kind support from Rhode Island Public Radio.
Additional engineering by James Baumgartner. Special thanks to Tori Malatia.
And one last word from Stephen Porter, who just realized maybe he should cut something else from his diet.
You know, cheese production means meat production, because if you're going to keep cows lactating, then you need to keep them having baby cows. And so now I'm worried that my cheese, which has largely replaced meat, is just as bad.